I have to be honest with you, when I first saw the source packet for this, I had a very specific idea of what we were getting into.
Oh, yeah.
The file was titled Scientific Analysis of Avian Banding Data. So I'm thinking, finch migration, maybe how they put those tiny rings on puffins, bird stuff.
That is a very reasonable assumption. It sounds like an ornithology paper for sure.
Right, but then I open it up and there is not a single feather in this whole stack. Instead of birds, we are looking at, well, heavy metallurgy, the microstructure of steel, to be specific.
We are. It seems there was a bit of a clerical error somewhere, but I'd argue it's a good thing because what we're actually diving into is banding in steel. And while it's not about tracking birds, it is about how steel organizes itself into these, distinct layers that tell us its history.
It's actually fascinating. I mean, once you get past the lack of birds, one of the first things that jumped out at me was the analogy they used. They compared the inside of the steel to onion
It was a
rings.
vivid image, isn't it?
It really is, because you look at a steel beam and it just looks solid, gray, uniform, boring. But you slice it, you polish it, and suddenly you see these stripes. Light, dark, light, dark, like wood grain.
Exactly.
And so our mission today is to figure out why a liquid soup of metal decides to sort itself into layers, and more importantly, does it matter? If I'm building a bridge, do I care if my steel has stripes?
And the answer to that is, well, it's surprisingly nuanced. Because usually in engineering, we want uniformity, we want everything to be the same everywhere.
Right.
But nature and thermodynamics, they often have other plans.
So let's get into the why. How do we get these stripes? My assumption was always that steelmaking is, well, it's like baking. You melt the ingredients, you mix them up, and you pour it. It should be a smoothie, not a layer cake.
In a perfect world, yes. But you have to remember that steel has a memory. It remembers how it's solidified. When that liquid steel starts to freeze, it doesn't just turn into a block all at
It
once.
grows crystals. This is where the dendrites come in.
Exactly. Dendrites. From the Greek for tree, they look like tiny frost patterns on a window, growing out into the liquid. But here's the catch, and this is the root of the whole issue. As these crystal trees grow, they're incredibly picky eaters.
Picky eaters, what? They only want the good stuff.
Well, the solid crystal just wants the iron. It tends to reject the other stuff, the alloying elements like manganese, silicon, phosphorus. So as the tree grows, it pushes those elements away.
Out into the liquid that's still around the branches.
Precisely.
Okay, so let me get this straight. The trunk and the branches are forming first, and they're basically pure steel, but the liquid space between the branches gets concentrated with all the leftovers.
Exactly. We call it the interdendritic region. So before the steel is even fully solid, you already have this chemical segregation, spots with low manganese and spots with high manganese.
So it's a texture at first, a kind of forest of chemically different trees, but that's a 3D mess. How do you get from that to flat, parallel lines?
That's the processing. We don't just cast steel and leave it, we roll it, we smash it, we draw it out. Imagine taking that forest of segregated spots and running it through a pasta maker.
Oh, I see. So you're physically smearing the segregation out?
You're stretching those manganese-rich spots into long, flat pancakes, and when you look at the cross-section, they look like bands.
So the chemistry sets the blueprint, and the rolling mill actually builds the shape.
That's a perfect way to put it.
But here's the part that confused me a bit. We have these bands of high and low manganese, fine, but the stripes we actually see are made of ferrite and perlite. How does manganese turn into perlite?
Ah, okay, so this is the crux of it. You have to follow the carbon. When the steel cools, it wants to transform into ferrite and perlite. Now, ferrite is basically pure iron. It hates impurities, so it starts to form in the cleanest part of the steel.
Which would be the old tree trunks, the low manganese zones.
Correct. So the ferrite starts growing there. But ferrite can't hold much carbon. It's like an exclusive club that doesn't let carbon in. So as it grows, it pushes the carbon out of the way.
It's sweeping the carbon into the neighbor's yard.
Exactly. And the neighbor is the high manganese region. And here's why manganese is the villain of the story. It acts like a trap for carbon. It makes the carbon very comfortable there.
So the carbon is being pushed by the ferrite and at the same time pulled by the manganese.
A push-pull effect, yes. So all the carbon ends up concentrated in those manganese-rich bands. And when you have high carbon, what do you get?
You get perlite.
Get perlite, the dark stripe. So the chemical segregation directs the carbon, and the carbon dictates the structure.
That makes a lot of sense. But just when I thought I had it, I saw this curveball in the data about high sulfur steel, where the whole thing seemed to run in reverse.
Ah, yes. The high sulfur inversion. This is a classic example of how other elements can flip the script. If you have a lot of sulfur, it loves manganese even more than the steel does. They combine to form manganese sulfide, little solid particles.
So the sulfur basically ties up the manganese.
And locks it away. So in the regions where you used to have high manganese, the sulfur strips it out of the solution to make these little rocks. And suddenly that region becomes manganese poor.
Wow. So the rich neighborhood becomes the poor neighborhood.
Exactly. And since the manganese is gone, that area now looks like the cleanest spot for ferry to form. So the ferry forms there instead. The bands completely invert.
That is just wild. It shows how dynamic this whole process is.
It is. And for a long time, this was all just a theory. Metallurgists thought manganese was the driver, but they needed to prove it.
Which brings us to the artificial banding experiment. I absolutely loved this part.
It's a brilliant, elegant experiment.
So instead of letting nature do the work, they forced it. They made a steel sandwich, right?
They did. They took sheets of high manganese steel and sheets of low manganese steel, stacked them up high, low, and bonded them together. A perfect composite.
Controlling the variables. I love it. No dendrites, just I put the manganese here.
Right. Then they heated it up, hit the reset button on the structure, and let it cool. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, ferrite formed in the low manganese layers, and perlite formed in the high manganese layers.
Smoking gun.
Confirmed the mechanism perfectly. But did you catch the anomaly in that experiment about the layer thickness?
I did. I was hoping you'd explain it. In the really wide, thick layers of high manganese steel, the center didn't turn into perlite. It turned into something else, bainite or martensite. Why?
It all comes down to diffusion. Carbon has to physically move through the metal. That takes time.
And if the band is too wide?
The carbon can't reach the center in time. The diffusion distance is too great. So the center of that thick band is left with lower carbon, and it's not stable enough to become perlite. It shears into bainite or martensite instead.
That is such a cool detail. It shows that geometry matters just as much as chemistry.
It's a race against time and distance. And the center of the band lost that race.
Speaking of geometry, how do you even measure this? I assume you can't just look and say, yeah, that looks pretty stripey.
No, stripey is not a recognized standard, unfortunately. You need numbers. The most common method is surprisingly manual. It's called lineal intercepts.
Which is literally drawing lines on a picture and counting.
Pretty much. You draw a line perpendicular to the bands and count how many you cross. Then you draw one parallel.
And the ratio tells you how bad the banding is.
Exactly. If the ratio is 1, it's random. If it's high, you've got strong banding. There are more complex ways, of course.
The microstructural anisotropy tensor. I admit I glazed over a bit at the math there.
It's just a way of mapping that orientation in 3D. A sphere means it's uniform. A cigar or pancake shape means it's banded. It lets engineers plug the structure into simulations.
Which leads us to the big question, the so what? Does it ruin the steel? If I'm an engineer, do I need to panic if I see banding?
That's the intuitive assumption, right? We think of wood splitting along the grain.
Exactly.
But the data is really counterintuitive.
I was so surprised by this, the tensile strength and ductility. They're basically identical.
For the most part, yeah. And the reason is that the perlite, the hard band, is usually the minority. The bulk of it is soft, ductile ferrite.
So the ferrite sort of cushions everything.
In a way. The whole volume has to deform together. The bands are so close, we're talking 7 micrometers apart, that the stress can't really isolate itself in one weak direction. The lasagna holds together.
So structurally, the bridge isn't going to snap because of stripes.
Correct. Even impact toughness isn't significantly worse, provided you don't have other nasty inclusions.
Okay, so structurally we're safe, but there is one area where banding really matters. And it's not about breaking, it's about rotting.
Corrosion. This is the Achilles heel.
The numbers were just stark. In salty carbonated water, the penetration rate for the banded steel was, what, almost 6.5 millimeters a year? And for the uniform steel, it was much, much lower.
Almost twice as fast in the worst case. That's a massive difference for infrastructure that needs to last 50 years.
So why? What is it about the stripes that invites the rust?
It's electrochemistry. Ferrite and perlite have different electrical potentials. So when you put them next to each other in a liquid, you create a galvanic couple.
A battery.
Millions of microscopic batteries. The ferrite acts as the anode, and the perlite is the cathode. In a battery, the anode is the part that dissolves.
So the ferrite bands literally get eaten away.
They do. And because they're in bands, you don't just get surface rust, you get grooves. The rust digs deep along the ferry channels. It's a localized attack.
So if I'm building a bridge over the ocean or a pipeline, I really, really don't want banding. It's going to rot from the inside out.
It's a huge durability risk.
Yeah.
You're basically building a self-destruct mechanism into the material.
So can we fix it? Can we unband the steel?
We can, but every solution has a price. The most obvious one is homogenization.
Just mix it better.
But the segregation is locked in the solid. So to mix it, you need heat. Lots of heat. The text says you'd need to hold the steel at 1250 degrees Celsius.
For how long?
For about 24 hours.
Ouch. 24 hours at that temperature. Industrially, that sounds like a non-starter.
It's just not viable for commodity steel. It would make it incredibly expensive.
Okay, so baking is out. What about that metallurgical trick with the grain size?
Right. It's a clever workaround. We know ferry likes to grow in the low manganese bands, but it also likes to grow on the boundaries of the parent crystals.
Two competing starting lines.
Right. So if you make those parent grains huge, the ferrite changes how it grows. It shoots out in these long, needle-like plates.
Widman-Stettin ferrite.
And those needles grow so fast and so straight that they just ignore the chemistry. They cut right across the manganese bands.
So it overwrites the chemical blueprint with a structural one.
Yes. It masks the banding. But large grains have their own downsides. Lower toughness, usually. It's always a trade-off.
And the last option, the nuclear option. Just freeze it fast.
The quench. If you cool it incredibly rapidly, you don't give the atoms time to move.
The carbon gets frozen in place.
Exactly. You form martensite instead of ferrite and perlite. And martensite shows almost no banding. But again, trade-offs. It's hard as a rock, but brittle as glass until you temper it.
It really seems like there is no free lunch in metallurgy.
There never is. You're always balancing strength, ductility, cost, and corrosion.
This has really changed how I look at a piece of steel. You think of it as this, you know, cold, dead thing. But it's actually this frozen history of chaos. It remembers the dendrites. It remembers the rolling mill.
It's full of these microscopic batteries fighting each other.
Exactly.
You know, it brings up a bigger point for me. In engineering, we are obsessed with homogeneity. We want control. We want every single bit to be identical.
But nature wants a variety.
Physics pushes for segregation, for patterns. Even in a massive manufactured steel beam, the ghost of those original liquid crystals is still there, haunting the microstructure. You can squash it, you can heat it, but you can't easily erase that memory.
The ghost in the girder. I love that.
It keeps the job interesting.
Well, I am glad we spoke with this file. Even with the misleading avian title, I think we learned a lot more from the onion rings of steel than we would have from a puffin.
I certainly enjoyed the detour, though I do hope the bird researchers eventually got their data back.
I'm sure they did. And thank you to everyone listening. Hopefully the next time you see a rusty bridge, you'll think about the microscopic battle happening inside.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.